I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this first day of December. Hour one of our program today. Our guest has written that political uncertainty surrounding a Trump administration adds confusion to a task that was already extraordinarily difficult, and that is global warming. But there is a hope, he writes in a recent article, that the negative impacts of U.S. climate policy under Trump will be limited by the current momentum in technological advancement. He is with us this hour, Gernot Wagner, and he is a research associate at Harvard School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, a lecturer on environmental science and public policy, and associate at the Harvard University Center for the Environment, co-author of Climate Shock and author of But Will the Planet Notice? He teaches climate policy, past, present, and future at Harvard, and he is with us this hour to talk about where climate change policy will go. We have conflicting signals from the president-elect. We can talk about where other countries are going and what the impact of a Trump administration will be on COP22. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Gernot, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Good to be here.
Very nice to have you here. So you start the article that you wrote recently, the Monday before the U.S. presidential election, climate negotiators are in Marrakesh, Morocco, to begin the process of implementing the Paris Climate Agreement. All eyes are on the U.S., and then what?
And then Trump gets elected on Tuesday, 2 days into the Marrakesh negotiations, which is this annual confab when climate negotiators get together. And this was the very first meeting after the Paris Agreement had been signed and, in fact, had been ratified. So it's already in force. And now the big question, of course, is what happens to climate policy post-Trump?
Was there a concern among the people gathered there? Were they all very, very worried, or did they see signs of hope?
So certainly both. So first, of course, right, as frankly, very few people, right, climate negotiators, of course, among them, no one really predicted that Donald Trump would win this election, or very, very few people predicted outright that Donald Trump would win this election. So, frankly, there was a lot of stunned silence in the room at first. And then, very quickly thereafter, right, things moved on to, okay, so what do we do now? Donald Trump, of course, did not get elected to advance climate policy. He did not run on this platform. He, of course, has said very, you know, sort of confusing things, frankly, about where he personally stands on climate change and where his administration will go on climate change. And frankly, there was a lot of, well, A, confusion in the room, and B, hope that in some sense things will not be quite as bad as the latest tweet would lead us to believe.
You write that China is seeking to take the climate leadership mantle from the United States under a Trump presidency. China's vice foreign minister addressed Trump's claim that climate change is a Chinese hoax designated to hurt U.S. competitiveness. What did the foreign minister have to say in that regard? And do you think that China, and would they do a good job of taking the climate leadership mantle?
Well, in some sort of very ironic way, it is in fact now left to the Chinese to do take this leadership mantle, if they like it or not, right? So, the Europeans have always been doing quite a bit on climate and have basically been the global leaders when it comes to putting concrete climate policy on the table, which essentially always left the U.S. and China as the two major emitters, emitters number one and two when it comes to global CO2 emissions. And their eyes had always been on them. Now, of course, under President Obama, there have been some success stories within the U.S., some successful steps in the right direction when it comes to federal climate policy. And now that President Trump got elected. It is unclear that this will continue in the U.S., to say the least. So all eyes are on China to, in fact, take the mantle from the U.S. in terms of, right, here is concrete movement on the ground when it comes to climate policy to do something that, in fact, has positive effects on the rest of the planet as well.
Back to China in a moment. Let's talk about recent emission reductions in the United States. You cite there are three key drivers of those reductions, and I'm wondering if you could outline those for us and tell us if those policies that were in place to allow the reductions to take place in this country would continue.
So, yes, right, emissions in the U.S. over the last 10 years or so have gone down quite a bit, and not necessarily because of strong federal climate policy, but because of other factors. So those three factors are the shift from coal to natural gas, which in many ways is not driven by policy, but is simply driven by the fact that due to fracking, natural gas is a lot cheaper now than it used to be, and in effect is cheaper than coal. So it's the fuel of choice when it comes to producing electricity. That's one. The second is energy efficiency, demand reductions. Some of that is very much due to policy and political steps in the right direction. Some of it is simply technological advances moving in the right direction so we can now produce more by using less electricity. That's a second big step. And the third, of course, is, in fact, renewables, right? So the price of solar panels has declined by some 80%.
80%? That's huge.
That is huge, yeah. Yes. And actually, that's the hopeful sign, frankly, right, that trend will continue. It's certainly not going to go backwards. And frankly, that kind of trend is entirely outside the grasp of the federal government, right? Now, of course, right, does basic investment in R&D, research and development, help to increasingly decarbonize the electricity sector? Yes, of course, right? Many of the advances we see today are due to R&D investments decades ago. That said, those trends, right, the minus 80% for solar PV, photovoltaic, that's not going to go back. Solar is cheap, much, much cheaper than it has ever been. Donald Trump is not going to be able to reverse that trend, even if he wanted to. And, of course, frankly, he wouldn't want to, right? That is good for all of us. And, you know, when it comes to solar and wind energy, it turns out, well, much of the wind, of course, in this country turns out to be in Midwestern states that most of which voted for Trump in the recent elections. So this is not a partisan issue, right? Or it shouldn't be a partisan issue. If you're the Republican governor of Texas, you would want to continue the kinds of policies that have allowed Texas to produce more wind energy than any other state in the country.
Mm. And if you were in Florida, what was on the ballot in Florida concerning solar power?
Well, actually, that's an interesting case, right? So Florida, of course, famously voted for Trump in the election. Florida voters also voted against a proposition that would have ended or at least scaled back significantly subsidies for solar power within the state. So in other words, right, there too you see a very clear sign. On the one hand, yes, a vote for President Trump. On the other, a close but still a vote for a continuation of direct support for solar PV, for solar power.
When you mentioned earlier the change from coal to gas, you also mentioned the problems with the leaking of methane, and that's a potent greenhouse gas, and it could be a byproduct of natural gas extraction. How much do we know about that, and how much does the government need to become involved if we are to look at that as a big source of greenhouse gas? What can be done to prevent that leaking?
I mean, the short version is it takes direct regulation off methane, of methane leakage, in order to avoid leakage. That, in effect, would make natural gas a worse fuel than coal, right? So once you burn natural gas, if and when it gets burned, it is half as bad as coal. In other words, you can produce the same electricity by emitting half the CO2 emissions. But that's only when you burn it. When natural gas leaks on the way from the well to the point where it is being burned, natural gas itself turns out to be mostly methane, and methane itself is a very, very potent greenhouse gas that is more potent than CO2, so leaked methane would do a lot of damage to the climate. In other words, it takes regulation. It takes direct intervention to ensure that this kind of leakage is minimized in order to ensure that a move from coal to natural gas is in fact good for the climate.
And what are we doing in that regard? Anything?
Well, the Obama administration has put forward strong regulations to that effect. And, of course, that is exactly one of the ways where a President Trump could, in fact, take a step backwards by essentially instructing EPA not to move forward with these regulations and not reining in the leakage of methane of natural gas.
Before we talk about what states are doing, let's look at this whole issue of international cooperation, which seems to be very, very difficult. There have been so many meetings. It's been so hard to come up with any kind of agreement. What does President say? And we don't exactly know where Donald Trump is going to go with this issue. He said one thing, and then he said he's open to looking at other parts of the issue of climate change. But considering how hard it is to get all these countries to agree to reduce emissions, and the U.S. being very important in that regard, what about international cooperation? What about what's happening in Europe and the rise of nationalism in those countries, in, you know, in France and in England, in many places in Europe? Does it really fracture this international cooperation that's needed?
It does, right? In short, that is the biggest worry in all of this. It's not so much that someone in the White House who wanted to dismantle every single positive climate policy in this country is going to have that much of an effect. Now, of course, there is that too. There's the direct effect. But frankly, sort of to talk concrete numbers, that might be 1 or 2 or maybe 5 billion tons of CO2, which is billion with a B, right? That is important. That matters over the next 4 or 8 years or so. On the other hand, it is in fact, sadly, very, very small relative to total emissions going into the atmosphere. Now, if there are global knock-on effects that would lead to a dismantling of climate policy elsewhere, so in other words, right, if let's say the Chinese look to Washington, D.C. and say, oh, they are not doing anything anymore, why should we? If that were the reaction, that would be a bad, bad step for climate overall. It's this unraveling of these global climate policies. Now, if the opposite happens, or for that matter, since signs do point toward the opposite in fact happening, as in the Chinese saying, oh, wait, the U.S. is no longer investing or seems to be no longer investing as much in these clean, lean, mean climate low-carbon technologies as they had proposed only recently, then how about us, right? Why don't we take this leadership mantle from the U.S.? Because it turns out it's good for the climate on the one hand. Well, it's also good for jobs. It's good for the economy. It's good for us as the Chinese to be seen as the producer of that low-carbon technology. And, of course, also in this case now increasingly a user of those low-carbon technologies because, well, if the U.S. is buying less of that equipment, then why not have that be, right? Why not have China be ahead of the curve here and increasingly move in the right direction?
I'm wondering, you see all these reports of people not being able to go to work in China because the smog is horrific, and the pictures, it just looks like this dense fog is over some of the major cities in China. Are they seeing, just in terms of the air that they breathe, and they're having a hard time breathing some of the air, that it's more evident? We have our own indications of climate change, but if you can't go to work because the air is so bad, is that also pressing China to take the lead here?
Absolutely, right? So it turns out when you burn coal, yes, you produce CO2, and that is bad for the global climate. You also produce a lot of local pollutants, and those are very, very bad for the local environment, right? So you knock off quite a few years of your average expected lifespan by having excess pollution. Yeah. Now, of course, right, we in the U.S. here, we have done quite a lot in that respect over the last few decades with the Clean Air Act and Clean Air Act amendments of 1990. In China, there's a lot of catching up to do. And, of course, the big, big benefit of doing precisely that, of focusing on local air pollution, of cleaning up right the air that the average Chinese, or at least the average resident of major cities in China, breathes, a big, big benefit of that is that, frankly, it means often shutting down coal plants, or at least running them more often, less often.
Yes.
And of course, right, that has also positive effects on the climate.
Gernot Wagner is our guest this hour. He wrote a very interesting piece, COP, COP22, After Trump, the Good and Bad News for Climate Change. People from countries all over the world, 195, have been gathering to begin the process of implementing the Paris Climate Agreement, and all of this comes with a change and a dramatic change of administration here in the United States, with many of us in this country not exactly knowing what direction Donald Trump will go with the issue of climate change. So what does it mean for the world? We're speaking with Gernot, who is a research associate at Harvard School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. He's a lecturer on environmental science and public policy, associate at the Harvard University Center for the Environment, and he teaches climate policy past, present, and future at Harvard. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. We have covered this issue so often on this program. What are your concerns? Are they substantial about a change administration? Do you believe that Donald Trump is indeed open to looking at information on climate change and to having the United States be a leader in reduction of carbon emissions? What about China becoming the leader? Is that okay? Do we look to them now to come up with new technologies that will help us all through a warming planet? We would love to hear from you. And we'll take your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network. 800-486-8655, our number. Matthew in Stillwater, Minnesota. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, Kathleen. Love you guys. My comment is, I think all we need to do is read the tea leaves with who he's surrounding himself with. And he kind of elaborated to that maybe a little bit while he was campaigning for the presidency. And he's like, I'm going to surround myself with the best people, because he doesn't know how to do this job. I don't think anybody really knows how to do this job, but I think he's surrounding himself with people that are definitely not on the side of the environment. And that's my two cents, and I really appreciate you.
Thanks, Matthew. Thanks very much for the call. What do you think about the people who are surrounding him on this issue?
I mean, frankly, that is not a very hopeful place to start. So it turns out that several of the people who have been hired first to his administration, or proposed to take prominent positions in his administration, are in fact avowed climate deniers, or have in many ways sort of better formed opinions on this issue. Unfortunately, they are on the wrong side of science and history, for that matter. So looking at Donald Trump's personal positions, in many ways, or lack thereof, if you will, is a much more hopeful view of the world than looking at some of the, frankly, you know, DC insiders who are now working with him, for him, and who are, in fact, looking at climate through a wrong lens, denying climate science in the first place, or frankly having had a history of working on trying to question the basic science, do everything possible to ensure that sensible climate policy is not in fact happening anytime soon.
Hmm. But Gernot, I believe he had some 2,300 scientists deliver a letter today or yesterday talking about how important this issue is. Once you become president, you would take that seriously, wouldn't you? All of those scientists talking about this is a crucial, crucial issue our planet is facing.
Here's hoping. On the other hand, there is, of course, a reason why those 2,300 scientists organized by the Union of Concerned Scientists, in fact, felt it necessary to sign this this letter, because the initial signs, especially the signs during the campaign, of course, weren't all that hopeful that science, facts, would be front and center in this administration.
Thanks, Matthew, for your call. Jane in Madison is next. Hi, Jane.
Yes, this 1 minute won't do it, but I'm reading Harvard University's small organic molecule-based battery, flow battery for grid storage of solar and wind power. And since this is a Harvard University project, I know the Chinese are working on it. I know the British are working on it. Could you explain how this could be a game changer in creating a this would be organic that dissolves. It doesn't harm the environment. And it's Harvard University. Could you please explain?
Happy to try. So it turns out Harvard is big, so this is certainly not my project, I have to tell you. On the other hand, yes, so this is Dan Nocera, who's a professor here, who has been working on essentially organic storage technologies for a while and has had some breakthroughs of late. Let me back up. So if there were a way, right, to produce electricity cheaply without CO2 emissions, and of course increasingly there is, that in itself, of course, is a big step in the right direction. Now, when it comes to renewables, wind and solar energy, it turns out the wind doesn't always blow, sun doesn't always shine. The technical term is they are intermittent. We need some kind of storage technology that will allow us to use the wind and sun as, frankly, the sole suppliers of electricity. Now, it takes batteries. It takes some kind of battery to do this. And actually, there too, I mentioned before, these are amazing advances in solar PV technology, minus 80% costs over the last 5 to 10 years. For batteries too, we have over the last 5-7 years seen an amazing decrease in costs of about 80% as well, negative 80%. Now, that has very little to do with this particular project, but the general decrease in the cost of energy storage is very clearly a step in the right direction. And frankly, this is sort of the beauty of these clean technologies. They are, in fact, technologies. Or in other words, right, oil, coal, natural gas are commodities. Commodity prices will go up, they will go down, they will fluctuate. You don't know where the price is going to be tomorrow. Best guess is, frankly, where it is today, plus minus a few percent. For technologies, like solar PV on the one hand, wind on the other, battery storage technology, those technologies, the price in many ways can only go down. They can only become cheaper, better. And, of course, that is precisely one of these underlying technological trends that makes me hopeful. Costs will go down. They will become increasingly more available, and they will have a much, much bigger role in the near future than they currently have.
You mentioned earlier research and development money. I'm wondering the federal government's role in that, and if you can tell us if that amount of money is crucial to making these new technologies flourish?
Yes and no. So it is crucial for the fundamental research to develop these ideas in the first place, for then, right, 10, 20, 50 years down the line to be commercializable technologies available. It turns out, right, there's very little federal money going into, let's say, the commercialization of solar PV technology today, frankly, because it is already competitive. It is already, right, worthwhile for individual entrepreneurs to be putting their own dollars, their own investments into this technology, because there are returns to be had. It is profitable to be deployed. deploying these kinds of technologies today. So in other words, R&D, federal R&D, is crucial for inventing the next big thing. For deploying existing technologies, that's where the market comes in. That's where individual entrepreneurs come in who, you know, frankly, of course, want to make a buck while they're doing that, and who are increasingly able to do make a buck while deploying clean technologies.
We go, Jane, thanks for your call. Mary in Madison. Hello, Mary.
Hello. Yes, I heard that Switzerland is trying to phase out their nuclear plants. Are they confident that they'll have a low population where they can do this?
Well, it turns out nuclear is one of these very, very interesting and very, very difficult issues, right? We have, frankly, Japan phase out its nuclear fleet almost overnight after, or at least shut them down temporarily after the Fukushima accident. Angela Merkel in Germany proposing and now pulling through with a nuclear phase out. We have France, which gets more than 70% of its electricity from nuclear energy, looking at, frankly, a lot of aging nuclear plants and a big, big question of what to do next. And, of course, then there's the U.S., right? So we, too, get 20-plus percent of our electricity from nuclear energy right now, depending on the region, much, much more than just those 20%. And we, too, are looking at an aging nuclear fleet where it is unclear what the next steps are. Right, so we haven't built any new nuclear plants in quite a while. Meanwhile, nuclear technology is, in fact, the largest source of carbon-free electricity on the planet right now. Now, of course, plenty of other issues there as well to discuss. But if what you care about is climate, if CO2 emissions is the biggest concern, then, frankly, nuclear ought to be part of the conversation at the very least. It has to be on the table in order to generate a carbon-free electricity mix that can only be, at the moment, can only be achieved by taking nuclear energy seriously. Mm.
Gernot, you've talked about a need to develop advanced modular reactors for our nuclear fleet. You say they could be deployed much more cheaply and safely than current technologies, and also, which is crucial these days, support for the idea is broadly bipartisan, so we ought to be able to proceed with this under a new presidency. How difficult is this new technology? Are we looking at it now, and what are these advanced modular reactors?
That's a good question. So in many ways, it's pretty easy to talk about how advanced technology ought to be the thing we are deploying, because of course, right, if you're talking about, you know, amazing advances, both in terms of safety and cost for that matter, that could be a game changer. Now, very concretely, it does turn out that there were two bills that were advanced over the last year or so, one in the Senate, one in the House, that would provide support for these kinds of advanced nuclear technologies, and that is, in fact, what's necessary. Right now, nuclear technology is very costly. The generation of nuclear energy is very costly. Why is that the case? Well, to a large extent, because of the regulations imposed on the industry, often for very, very good reason, of course, right? We all know about the recent and not so recent nuclear accidents and the very real need for regulation of nuclear energy. On the other hand, of course, there is a risk-risk balance here to be struck. Right? Climate change is the global risk problem, if you will. Well, nuclear technology provides risks and now comes with risks. And now the big question is, right, are we currently striking the right risk-risk trade-off here? And of course, opinions differ widely on this question. But I would like to think it is sensible to argue that we are, in fact, not. That nuclear technology ought to play a bigger role than it currently does. And yes, this is a big, big regulatory question. And frankly, there are no easy answers, right? There are some very good reasons why some people would object to a nuclear plant in their backyard. And there are some very, very good reasons why, when you look at the climate problem overall, why moving more towards nuclear technology would in fact be worth the risk, would in fact be worth the investment.
Thank you so much, Mary, for your call. Verilyn in Lansing, Iowa. Hi, Verilyn.
Hi. Say, regarding sand fracking that you're talking about a little while ago, most people don't understand or realize how dangerous that is to you. When you and I know, because in Alameda County we banned it, and Winona, Minnesota has banned it now also, and over in across Wisconsin, that area is still wide open. But when they open up that fine sand, then they have to wash it, and those particles are so fine they blow all over, and they actually can cause lung cancer by getting into your lungs. And when I go to certain meetings where they are advocating sand fracking, why I'm a health food nut, I guess you might say. And anyway, in the health food stores, you can buy these long, slender tubes that are about an inch and a half. And got and about a foot and a half long, and they got frack sand in them, and then you spray that on the floor, around the floor, in the basement or wherever, and the bugs walk over it, and they cut themselves and they die. It's non-toxic, non-poisonous, but when you have an open sand pit and then you wash it and so on like that, and then it blows around the neighbors and so on like that, that sand frack goes into the lungs and cuts their lungs.
Yeah. Are you concerned about fracking?
Or am
not?
I?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, so yes, I am concerned in the sense that there are, of course, plenty of environmental issues, as frankly there are with any technology, right? There are toxins in solar panels, turns out. There are heavy metals in solar panels. No, I don't want to, right, essentially embrace any single technology as being the answer. There simply is no single answer to any of this, right? It has to be, to use an overused term, all of the above, or at the very least, right, there has to be a portfolio of approaches, a mix of energy generation technologies, right? And in certain areas, certain technologies, of course, ought to be preferred over others. Just that, all that said, much like with nuclear, frankly, we are very much talking about risk trade-offs here, right? It is one thing to say, oh, wouldn't it be nice to lead the lives we currently lead with, right, CO2-free, pollution-free energy, or to essentially, well, take a more realistic view, I would argue, and to say, right, every technology comes with risks. Coal generation obviously comes with lots and lots of environmental costs and risks. So does nuclear, so does natural gas, so does solar PV and wind, for that matter, to a much lesser extent, of course, and so does hydro generation, of course, right? Every generation technology comes with its costs, comes with some benefits. And the big question, of course, frankly, for policymakers, both at the federal and the state level, is how to strike the right balance.
Mm-hmm. We welcome more phone calls. We're talking about the Donald Trump presidency and what direction he's likely to go when it comes to climate change. Of course, this is an issue that is of concern to countries on Earth. And Gernot Wagner wrote a piece that caught our attention, COP22, After Trump, the Good and Bad News for Climate Change, how the climate negotiators are responding to the election of Donald Trump in the United States, and whether or not the world will be able to move ahead with taking on the issue of climate change. And so we're looking at the good news and the bad news this hour and welcoming your phone calls. Are you concerned about what the president-elect has said about climate change, but then he said something else, that he would be open to other information, that he was willing to go beyond what he had said about China and climate change during the campaign, that it was a Chinese hoax designated to hurt U.S. competitiveness. What are your hopes in this area? If you voted for Donald Trump, where did you think he would go on the issue of climate change? Where do you think he needs to go on the issue of climate change? We also have yet to talk about a lot of the policies come from the federal level on these issues, but there are also state things going on, and Gernot Wagner has written about those, and we will talk to him about those. He's a research associate at Harvard School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. He's a lecturer on environmental science and public policy, and he is the author of But Will the Planet Notice? He's also co-author Climate Shock, and he teaches climate policy, past, present, and future at Harvard. More phone calls momentarily. 800, couple lines open, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is The Ideas Network. Okay, back to phone calls. Rick, Fox City. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for the program. I wanted to ask the professor about agricultural policy with respect to climate. I know that soil is the second largest carbon reservoir on the planet next to the oceans, and just wondered what he might recommend, especially at the state level, for policymakers.
Excellent question, Rick. And so, yes, right, there is a lot that can and should be done when it comes to basically making sure that whatever tilling techniques we use in the agricultural sector don't contribute to the problem, may actually help solve the problem, the climate problem. Now, that said, there is a big distinction here between CO2 in the geosphere, if you will, right, where we are digging CO2 up from by basically burning fossil fuels, and CO2 in the biosphere. So when you say agriculture is the second largest reservoir of CO2, that is true, except it's only, in fact, in the biosphere. In other words, the real question when it comes to climate policy is how do you prevent more CO2 being dug up in the first place, more fossil fuels being dug up in the first place and entering the biosphere, of which oceans and agriculture, of course, are very much part of. So that's, frankly, the primary emphasis of much of climate policy, in the sense that, right, when you have a cap and trade system or a carbon tax, a price on CO2, what you're trying to do first and foremost is prevent more fossil fuels to be dug up and burned. Now, a secondary effect, a very important additional effect, of course, is in fact when it comes to the effect on agricultural policy and creating the right incentives for farmers to be doing, right, using the right techniques, the right equipment to prevent even more CO2 from going into the atmosphere, or for that matter, taking the positive view of using the right techniques, the right tilling techniques, to ensure that as much CO2 is sequestered as possible. That's where state policies are very much important, to be setting the right incentives, setting the right tone. And frankly, that's also where we are back to sort of the state policies that are in fact in place today, from California to New York and everywhere in between, in 47 states, turns out of 50 in this country, that have active incentives for renewable energy, support for renewable technologies, and where state-level policies are crucial to be setting the right incentives.
47 states, that's impressive.
It is, yes. And yes, it's, of course, very much true that, frankly, the vast majority of these states have Republican legislatures, Republican governors. This is not a partisan issue, it turns out, when it comes to the actual effects on the deployment of clean technology, the right incentives for creating the industries of the future within your state borders. Of course, everyone wants that. Right?
Sure.
You don't even have to believe that climate change is real to want to be subsidizing in many ways. But of course, at the very least, encouraging these kinds of clean energies to be produced in your state, and manufacturers to be locating in your state, that's not a partisan issue, and it's in many ways not even a climate issue, right? It's just smart economic policy.
Yeah. Rick, thanks for your call. La Mer in Ashland. Hi.
Hi. Professor Wagner makes a good point about technology. Most people are in agreement that we have a problem with policy in the hands of government and money. Even Justin Trudeau approved deadly pipelines yesterday. The focus is we don't have time. We perish without water. The risks are either exploding in nuclear holocaust, destroying water. The people really have the issue. We have it in our hands now. And the water protectors really are the people with the wisdom and indigenous knowledge to move us in the direction of policy.
Thanks, the mayor, for your call. Gernot.
In short, yes, right? Local environmental issues, water policy, water protection, for that matter, is a crucial, crucial aspect that ought to be part of any conversation around climate policy. And frankly, we are back to those risk trade-offs, right? I mean, it's easy to talk in the abstract, of course, but of course, those are very real, right? It's very difficult to see how we can produce the kinds of, you know, the amount of electricity that, you know, supports our daily lives without any impact on the environment, right? There's always going to be some trade-offs. I mean, frankly, as an economist, right, that's sort of our favorite phrase, right? You can't always get what you want, right, as philosopher Jagger once said. So yes, there are trade-offs. We know that, right? And now the big, big question is, right, how do you strike the right balance? And yes, right, as let me mention, the technology is the key, of course, in many ways, right? The beauty of technology, if you will, is that it often, for the most part, can only move in the right direction. Now, that's not necessarily true in general without policy playing a role too, of course, right? So it turns out, in addition to, you know, getting better at producing solar panels, we are also getting better of getting more and more oil out of existing wells, right? We are better at finding additional oil. We are better at digging up more coal, right? So technology, of course, can go both ways too, which is precisely where policy comes in, and it's the intersection of the two that is so crucial here, right? If you will, it's sort of Silicon Valley meets Wall Street meets Washington, D.C. as the stand-in for smart policy here, which, of course, also has to happen at the state level.
Yeah. Gernot, what's happened with our consumption? And if you can give any kind of international comparison, that would be good. I know that you have looked at this. Has it gone down significantly?
Well, it turns out, so the consumption of electricity specifically has gone down in this country, right? Energy efficiency measures, demand response measures, essentially encouraging people to use less electricity by setting many of the right incentives while, by the way, producing more, right? So this is not a matter of, right, sort of going back to the caves, if you will, sort of using less and producing less. It is producing more while using less, using fewer inputs. That is certainly a very hopeful sign and a move in the right direction. Now, there too, of course, a lot depends on policy. So, for example, CAFE standards, corporate average fuel economy standards for cars, efficiency standards for cars, have been tightened twice in the last 8 years under the Obama administration.
Yes.
And they were, of course, steps in the right direction, right? Driving longer with less fuel input, of course, is a good thing. Now, that's precisely, by the way, where Donald Trump could, in fact, take a step backwards as well, because it does take policy, it takes federal policy, ideally, to be setting these kinds of standards. Of course, if there is a threat of preempting these standards or taking a step backwards, that would be a step backwards for the climate as well.
Let's go to Mitch in Green Bay. Hi, Mitch.
Hello. I've heard that there's a research area in China on solar, and one of the things they said was they're using vacuum tubes as a storage means. Is this a viable system or what?
Interesting. I guess, so I don't know a lot about that particular technology. All I can say is that, well, if it does things cheaply, right, if you can, in fact, for example, I don't know about vacuum tubes, but there are startups in this country that are trying to store electricity by compressing air in shipping containers, right, sort of shipping container-sized facilities. You compress air, and, of course, when you need the electricity, when you need the power, you release the air and you generate electricity again. One of the big questions, of course, is how much does this kind of technology cost? That is always, right, the major question. It's pretty easy to conceive of technologies that would be, you know, could work in theory, but then when you actually try to make them work, they cost too much to make them economically viable. On the other hand, well, whether it's vacuum tubes or storage containers or anything in between, the big question, of course, is how can we take advantage of as many of these technologies as possible? How can we make as many of these technologies as possible viable, economically viable? And once again, right, we are back to Silicon Valley meets Wall Street meets Washington, D.C. It takes all of the above. It usually takes all of the above. It does take policy to ensure that we are moving in the right direction as well.
Larry in Kenosha, hi.
Hi there. My question is, and I've asked numerous people this, is how much would the Earth have to cool by to at least maintain the glaciers as they are? And I would come back from Alaska this year, my son and I, and this was a park ranger, not some right-wing wacko, that said the glaciers are actually growing up there. Part of my problem, though, also has is Western Europe and the United States, as far as our what I've seen on some charts, our carbon is going down, and what ours has gone down by China and India have put out far more. Shouldn't we be concentrating more on China and India instead of trying to ruin our economy here in the United States?
All right, we have about a minute left, Gernot.
Well, very quickly, right? So in order to ensure that glaciers aren't melting, well, we would have to go back to the temperatures were, in fact, we've had for all along. In other words, you know, right now we've already warmed the planet by at least a degree and a half Fahrenheit since pre-industrial levels. Well, we'd have to go back to those pre-industrial times. That's point one. Point two on, right, who should be doing what? Now, of course, right, global climate change is a global problem. We all need to reduce our emissions. In fact, we need to reduce our emissions to zero. That's maybe sort of the most crucial point in all of this, right? It's one thing to talk about annual emissions having gone down. It's another to say, right, let's look at the atmospheric bathtub overall. That is, of course, still filling, even though the annual flow in, right, the water going into the tub may have been stabilized. But the real problem, of course, is the tub is still filling, right? We need to go down to zero emissions, or for that matter, less than zero emissions, to go back to the kinds of temperatures that would, in fact, ensure that, right, our glaciers, our polar caps, are remaining stable. That's the real problem, right? So much more is necessary.
Gernot, thank you so much. It's been such an informative hour, and I hope you'll join us again. It's an important issue. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathleen. Bye.
Gernot Wegner is a research associate at Harvard School of Engineering and Applied Scientist, author of Climate Shock and But Will the Planet Notice? And we thank him for his time. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the show, to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. News is coming up from National Public Radio. We'll talk about Wisconsin's recount, presidential recount, which started today. And we'll also look at the Democrats and diversity.